So I promised on Monday that I will reconsider the objective function we have to optimize for MR image or intensity inhomogeneity correction. The idea of the FACC means clustering is basically that we do both things in parallel. On the one hand, inhomogeneity correction, and on the other hand, the classification of the pixels in terms of their assignment to a particular tissue class. These are the two aspects we do in parallel, and that's the core idea of the FACC means clustering. That means we want to eliminate the low frequency change in the intensity surface, and we want to reduce the number of different intensity values in the resulting image to a limited number of tissue classes that are present in the image. Hello. And the side effect is that we will end up with images that require a low number of bits for quantization. The images usually look very different to the images you get out of the scanner, and the practical use of these images is rather limited in terms of diagnostic procedures. But anyways, it's a very smart algorithm, and it's a very important technique that allows us to eliminate the image inhomogeneities properly. And last Monday, I was explaining to you the term data similarity and the term prior knowledge. Data similarity means we have something in our objective function that measures the similarity of the data that are measured to some model that we want to construct. Yeah? So here, for instance, this term expresses how close the measurements, these are the intensity values we have measured, are to the intensity value CI that represents the ice tissue class that we are considering. And here we have a weighting factor that basically assigns a probability to the correspondence of XK to the class center CI. Now, that's the idea. So once again, what you have to keep in mind here is you have features in 2D. It's easier to show than in 1D. X1, X2, and you have centers. This is C1, and this is C2. And here, this is the Euclidean distance or Euclidean distance of the vector that we are currently considering to the center C1, respectively the distance to the center C2. If we have large distances, that means the data points are very dissimilar. If we have small distances, we say they are very similar. And here we have a pre-weighting factor that gives us a probability that this vector here is assigned to this class and this vector here is assigned to that class. Okay? And then I have explained to you prior knowledge. And prior or the regularizer that incorporates prior knowledge is only considering parameters that belong to the model. So they are independent of the XKs. They are independent of the observations. And to remember this 10 years from now, keep in mind the simple example, the probability, you get a newspaper, the probability that my name shows up there is way smaller than the name of our chancellor. Yeah? Because our chancellor is in press every day and we know that. And I'm not in press at all. Yeah, and that means without looking into the newspaper, you have some prior knowledge about the probability of something to happen. Okay, and now the point where I screwed the whole lecture up on Monday. the second term here is not part of the prior, but it's part of the data similarity or of the similarity measure, because there is still the observation in it. And what we want to measure by the second term is, and that was explained correctly, we want to enforce that pixels in a local neighborhood belong to the same tissue class. Yeah? And we do this on the basis of a data similarity term. First of all, we have the same like above. We just say we look at a feature indexed by k. Yeah? So what do we think here about is, in terms of an image, we have here our image grid. We take this point here, xk, that's the kth position in the image. Hello. The kth position in the image. And then we look at the neighborhood of the kth point. The neighborhood could be an image processing. If we do low-level image processing, this is usually some 3x3 neighborhood or a 5x5 neighborhood. Yeah. And then we look over all the intensities in the neighborhood. We sum over all the intensities in the neighborhood and measure the distance to the class center CI, weighted by the probability that the kth feature or the kth observation belongs to the ith cluster. So the kth point belongs to the ith cluster. And then we sum up over all the points. So we walk through the whole image, consider this for all the points, and then we consider this for all the clusters. And if we have to minimize this term, it's clear that in a local neighborhood, we want to have small values here. And if the values here are high, this AIK, broken English, this AIK, this will turn out to be smaller. Yeah? That's what the optimization procedure will enforce here. So if this is small, this will become high, because then the whole overall objective function will achieve a minimum. And if this is very, very high, this here will be very, very small. That's what we try to enforce. And with this, we have an objective function. And if we analyze the complexity of the objective function, meaning the complexity of the optimization problem that is associated with this objective function, we can have a look at it. What are our unknowns? Our unknowns are the class centers, CI. Our unknowns are the probabilistic assignments here. And that's it. Yeah? And that's it. And now let's look at the terms we have. Here, the AIK shows up in the power of D, and the CIs show up in the power of 2. So this is a nonlinear optimization problem with quadratic terms and terms where we have our unknown in the dth power, x power, to the power of D. So it's not obvious that this optimum is that we look for is unique. But if you compute the maximum or minimum or the extreme value, so extreme value of this objective function, you have to compute the derivative with respect to the components AIK and CI, because these are our unknowns. And it turns out what we expect for CI, we get a closed form solution. For the AIK, we also get a closed form solution, which is not so obvious. And now your question is, where is the bias field? We have the centers, we have our values XR, these are the observations, and we have our probabilistic assignments. And the trick now is that we replace XK by a sum of two variables where we say yk is the ideal intensity value and beta k, that's the bias. That's the bias. And so we plug this in here and replace xk by yk plus the bias, and we get the final, or plus or minus, it doesn't matter. That's just the scaling factor here. And we get this final objective function where the n kappa should be in, that was promised to be fixed and will be fixed soon today. And here we have our bias corrected value, and here we have our center. Okay? You're smiling? Is something wrong here? No. I don't hope so. Good. And now, as engineers, we can play around. Anything? Any problem? No? Okay. Don't make me nervous, because I messed it up on Monday, so I'm very sensitive to any reactions from your side today. You know, life changes a lot if you become a master's degree and you start to be a PhD student and you start to teach. From one day to the other, you are the guy who should know everything. But in fact, nothing has changed so much personally. Yeah, you're just on the other side of the business, but you're not smarter. And it doesn't change, even if you become a professor. I mean, you know some things better than others, but you are not the big guy who knows everything. At least that holds for me. Good. Now we are engineers. We are engineers, and we are here not to reproduce what others do, but also use our own ideas to extend things others did. What we could, for instance, do is, here, we know something about beta. We know that the betas should not change too much in the local neighborhood. Yeah? And we could express this also here in terms of an additional regularizer. We could say that the difference of the beta case, the beta case in a local neighborhood of xk, should not change too much. And we could have here an additional regularizer, for instance, saying that we have the sum over the neighborhood here, or let me call it this, the neighborhood L over N, and we request beta L to be as close as possible to beta k. If these are scalars, you just compute the absolute value and require this difference to be small, and you add here an additional term. I would not use the absolute value for the computations in the first shot. I would prefer a square, because then it's easier to compute the derivative. And then you do all the partial derivatives with respect to beta k, you will end up again with a closed form formula that looks different to anything that was published before, and you can write a paper on this. And then you run a few experiments and you have a paper. So if somebody here wants to do that, feel free to do that. Submit it, and if you get a trip to Hawaii, I will pay for it. If it's one of my students, I will pay for it. Okay. Hello. No problem, no problem. There is no need to explain yourself here. You have the videos. The only disadvantage is that you cannot ask questions during the videos. Okay. Yeah. You can also add another term, and that's what I was thinking of first last week, that this also holds for the CKs, the assignments of the classes in the local neighborhood. And you can extend another term. And now you might ask a question, well, can I build the objective function up with hundreds of different regularizers? You can do that, but this will only work to a certain extent. At some point, if you put too much in, then the whole function will not lead to useful results. So there is a working point where things are optimal. Okay? Good. Now you can be sure that I will not ask this in the oral exam. Why will I not ask this in the oral exam? Because if you screw it up in the oral exam, you can say the professor screwed it up as well, so you cannot downgrade my performance. So I will not ask this. Okay? But Andy might ask this. Andreas Meyer might ask this. And please don't tell him what happened. Okay? So it's a good exercise. Extend the objective function by this. Compute the estimators, that means the formulas to come up with the beta case. And then implement it in MATLAB, do some experiments, and write a paper. And you are in the middle of our research community. Good. Or what you could also do, yeah, to be creative, if you know that an image usually is brighter in the upper lines and darker in the lower lines, you can incorporate this here. Means the more the index goes to the lower part of the image, the darker the image should be. That means the smaller the beta case should be. And you can express these things in terms of regularizer. And it's some kind of art to design these things and to build it up and to do the experimental validation. Okay? Questions so far? I personally like this algorithm very much because it shows how standard pattern recognition techniques like vector quantization, what it is actually, can be applied to important problems in medical imaging. And now we will look at a probabilistic approach for bias correction, and that's what I started to explain on Monday as well. What we are now going to do is we will use properties of probability functions to deal with the issue of bias field correction. And again, we combine the two problems. One is inhomogeneity elimination, and the second is to assign the intensities to tissue classes and build up an algorithm that solves these two examples in parallel. And a brief reminder, and I did this on Monday in the continuous, so let's do it today again in the discrete. Let's assume you have a coin, okay? A coin, and you also have a coin, and you also have a coin. Yeah, and I trust you. Can I trust you?
Yeah.
Your coin is manipulated. Yeah, so her coin is manipulated. So it shows, we throw the coin, and I can identify your coin. What's your name?
May.
May? Mm-hmm. May's coin. I shouldn't know your name, but me.
Yeah.
May, me.
Mohammed.
Yeah. And I know your coin, and I know Mohammed's coin. And these can be identified, okay? And then I do a statistics. I don't know how to write your name. M. Like what? M? Ah, the month, okay, sorry. Of number. I estimate this. It's 1/2, yeah? And of head. I'm not sure, do you say head in English? Doesn't matter, you know what I mean, yeah? Kopf und Zahl is also 1/2. Should I write the Chinese characters? Okay. Nice try, I know. And I forgot. Yours is manipulated, right? Sorry. That was my prior, that you are honest, you know? And now it's manipulated. And Mohammed, is your coin manipulated?
No,
of course not. So these are the probabilities we have. Yeah? So we know whose coin we used, and I have determined the probabilities by using an experiment estimating relative frequencies. So I found out that your coin is manipulated. Okay? Good. And now the following happens. Like Monday, I forget whose coin belongs to whom here. So I don't have the assignment. I just know there are coins, and I throw one coin and I get a head or number. I get head or number. Hello.
Hello.
Nice to see you again. He will tell everybody there is a clown inside who was making fun of me. I scared him away? No. I'm a nice guy. At least I try to be. So we want to know what is the probability that we have number. If I don't know, whose coin I used, I have to marginalize here. Because if I say all the three coins are chosen with the same probability, so one-third, 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 I will use Mies or Mohammed's coin. And I don't know at the end whose coin is there. And I want to know the probability that I observe a number. I have to compute the marginal over all the persons. Yeah. So I have one-third of May number plus one-third of me number plus one-third of plus one-third of Mohammed's coin number. Yeah, we call this marginalization. We eliminate the random variable that characterizes the person the coin is from. Yeah. Or if you don't like the names, think about colors. The coins have different colors, and you have a grayscale camera, and you cannot distinguish between the cameras, and you observe a number, and you can ask what is the probability to get a number on the image or a head. And so you have to sum over all the colors, all the persons, and you get here this overall probability at the end. And more abstract, this means if you have a joint density of two random variables, sorry, P of X has to be computed, then you compute the marginal over all the Ys that you are not observing. And we will use exactly this idea in the following. I told you we want to estimate the bias, and we'd want to do the class assignment for each intensity. And at the end, we will come up with a probabilistic model where the class assignments, so the tissue classes of each pixel, are unknown. And we eliminate the tissue class by summing up over all tissue classes the PDF. That means the unknown assignment of a pixel to a tissue class is eliminated is eliminated. You are confusing me with your phone here. Are you taking pictures of me?
No.
Okay, good. I don't want to see them in the web. What?
There's a whole video to engineer photos from it.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, okay. There we are with privacy nowadays, right? It's horrible, right? Yeah. Good. Now I forgot what I wanted to say. So we can eliminate the unknown tissue class assignment by marginalization, and we are just done with it. Yeah. And the question now is, how can we build up this marginal? And there we are. We say the tissue classes are unknown and the bias field are unknown. And now it's a design issue. What do we consider as a random variable and what do we consider as a parameter of the density function? Yeah, so if I, for instance, consider a density function like the normal distribution, I can say x plus a, mi and sigma, and these are the mean vector and the covariance matrix here. These are the parameters of the density. So the degrees of freedom of the density. And this here is a random variable. The sum of two numbers. This here is a random variable we consider. And in our design, we can decide whether we want to have one measure as one element that we are looking for is a random variable and the other one is a parameter. That's a design issue. Yeah, that's a design issue. And what we are doing in the following is we assign the tissue class to be a random variable and the unknown bias field to be a parameter of our density. And the bias field estimation at the end of the day is a parameter estimation problem. And the estimation of classes is, at the end of the day, a maximum a posteriori estimation where we optimize a probability density function. And again, that's what we have discussed on Monday as well at the end. We have to distinguish between observable random variables. These are the measurements we do, the logarithmic intensity values. We have hidden random measurements. These are the tissue classes for each pixel. For instance, here, hidden measurements or hidden random variables would be here the name assigned to each coin that we throw. Yeah? If I don't know whose coin is which one, then I can say the name assignment is a hidden random variable. And then we can set up a parameter estimation problem if we consider the bias field to be a parameter. We can estimate the bias field using parameter estimation techniques we know from statistics. And now we have to build up a probabilistic model. Here, for instance, we have a probabilistic model for observing a number where we have incorporated the knowledge that we have coins of three different types. We have the prior for each coin. They are uniformly chosen because I just grab one by accident. And we know here the relative frequencies for each coin of each person. That's pre-computed using an experiment that I performed by just taking her coin, throwing it 5,000 times and just adding up the number of numbers, the number of heads divided by the number of total throws. And so I get these. So we can compute the probability of number and using an underlying model that incorporates detail knowledge. And if we, for instance, use an MR image of the human brain, one slice, we can use an anatomic atlas and we can count the probability, or we can estimate the probability that we have white brain matter, gray brain matter, water, bone, yeah? Because the relative frequencies can be estimated out of a huge number of data. And this can be used in a probabilistic model like we did it here with the name assignments. So Let's look at the probabilistic model for the observed intensities. We assume that the observed intensities are normally distributed, and we have here the mean value and here the parameter beta I, which is the offset, beta ij, which is the bias that we have. And this is the standard formula of the Gaussian probability density function that you should remember from school or from the first semester of your university career or wherever you have seen this. You remember? You have seen the normal distribution. Never? Never? Yeah. Yes, okay. Is there anybody who has never seen this? The Gaussian bell? And there's a formula for it. Yeah. If you remember the good old days when we had the Deutschmark, that 10, you don't remember that. There was on the 10 Deutschmarkschein bill, broken English, confused English, there was the Gaussian bell and the formula. Yeah. So everybody had access to this fantastic mathematical results in Germany, who had money, as usual. If you have money, you have access, yeah. And you saw how the mi is in the formula, that's the mean value and the variance. Yeah? Yeah, and we didn't ask him whether he agrees on publishing his face on the 10 mark schein, 10 mark Deutschmark bill, blah, 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 blah. Okay, good. Any explanation why I've used here the determinant? That's the determinant, by the way. Because this is a matrix and the absolute value, that means that's the determinant. And the usual prefactor of the Gaussian looks like this, 2 pi to the power of d, where d is the dimension of the random vector. And if you bring this into the determinant, you know this is just, if you bring it outside of the determinant, this is set to the power of the number of columns of the matrix. So I can write this independent of the dimension of the feature vector. That's just a trick, cosmetic trick that we use. Okay? You should also be familiar with covariance matrices. The covariance matrix is asymmetric matrix. Asymmetric matrix, positive definite matrix, and it can be inverted. The covariance matrix is nothing else but a sum of projection matrices. That's something I will teach in pattern recognition classes in detail. Okay, good. Now, last week I was, on Monday I was mentioning that we have a few ways to justify normal distributions. And one way to justify it is the engineering argument. Just say, if you want to build a probabilistic model and you have no clue, it's not bad to start with a normal distribution. Yeah. So normal distribution is not bad at all. You can always try it with a normal distribution. That's the first argument. The second is, and if you use it and it works, it's fine. Yeah, it's good enough. It works. If somebody asks you how do you justify that it's normally distributed, you can say it works. Yeah, it works better than other methods. It works. So it's justified. That's the engineering argument. Don't tell my colleagues in the math department that I'm saying things like that. Yeah, but we engineers can say and claim things like that. The other thing is you can do statistical testing. In statistics, there are many tests out there where you say, okay, I have the hypothesis that a random variable is normally distributed, and then you test it by a statistical test, and you get a confidence interval or a significance level for it at the end of the day that tells you it's normally distributed or not. And the other, and the third method is that by construction of the random variables you have, you know that they are normally distributed. For instance, that's true if you transform high dimensional vectors by a matrix vector multiplication to a low dimensional vector, you have a sum of the a weighted sum of the components. And there, the laws of statistics tell us if you have a linear combination of random variables, you will end up with normally distributed vectors. Yeah? For instance, the PCA, for the experts in the audience, the PCA leads to features that are normally distributed by construction. Okay, so keep this in mind. We do it, it works, it's fine. We test it and have a experimental support by statistical testing, or we know by construction that statistics imply that the features are normally distributed. And that's exactly what we did in this case. It, by experiments, we will show later on that the assumption of normally distributed features is valid in this context. And now let's build up this statistical model. And look at these formulas. Aren't they wonderful? They look so complicated, but I'll tell you, it's not so if you have these things in mind. We have tissue classes. We call our tissue classes gamma. Yeah, we call them gamma. So we have for each tissue class a prior probability. That's what we get out of an anatomic atlas. The prior probability that we have water, the prior probability that we have gray matter, white matter, or bone, for instance. Then we have a prior density of a bias field. That means the parameters we want to estimate, they also underlie a certain probability density function. You can look at the low frequency changes in MR images, and you see it's bright on one side, dark on the other side, and fit in a probability density function that characterizes this behavior in terms of the relative frequencies of the bias components. Again, what we do is we assume here normally distributed or Gaussian PDF. Normally distributed random variable or a Gaussian PDF. Why can I do that? Because we will show it works. We get good results. We show by experiment it works. You can also do it by statistical testing. Even in those cases where it works, it might violate the or might not be justified by a statistical test, so it's always worth doing the experiments at the end of the day. Okay, and now let's look at this term here. Forget about the sum. That's the probability that I observe a certain intensity value at point ij in the image for a given tissue class. That means I know the coin assignment, I know whose coin I'm using, and for a known bias field. And now I don't know the coin, I don't know the tissue class, so what I do is I multiply it with a prior that a certain tissue class shows up here. In our case it was 1/3 because all the three coins were chosen with the same prior probability. And then I say, I don't know the tissue class. I don't know the coin. What do I do? I sum up over all the intensity, all the tissue classes. So I eliminate the random variable. I build up a model where I assume that I know the class assignment, the tissue class assignment. And then I say, yeah, and that's the statistical model, but actually I do not know the class assignment. And then I say, well, if you don't know it in a probabilistic setup, you just marginalize by summing up over all the tissue classes. And that's the brilliant idea that shows how you can eliminate the class assignment here in the probability function. Yeah. That's a very cool idea, very nice. And this is something I already did on Monday using a little bit different notation. If I want to estimate a parameter using the maximum a posteriori estimate, I can use this estimate where I have the prior the prior plus the beta-dependent probability for the observation. I did that on Monday on the blackboard. And that's something that we are going to do right now as well. So what we want to do is we want to estimate basically the beta. And now we have multiple pixels in the image. So we have pixel number one, pixel number two, pixel number three. And now we say, what is the overall probability of the whole image for the observations given this bias field here? And for single observations with a single bias, we have seen on one of the previous slides that we can rewrite this in terms of a marginal. Yeah? This is exactly this marginal here. The probability that we observe this intensity value given a certain tissue class, given a certain bias, multiplied with the probability of the tissue class marginalized over the tissue class. And now we do something that quite often happens in probabilistic modeling in pattern recognition and image processing. We assume, and that's not true, that's not the true situation in the real world, but it's good enough for our experiments and for our practical setup. We assume that the intensities in the image are mutually independent. We assume that each pixel is independent of the neighboring pixel. And if we want to compute the joint density for the whole image, we multiply over all pixels the probability that we observe this intensity given this bias. Okay? This intensity given this bias, this probability is the marginal we have seen two slides before. So we can rewrite the probability of observing an image for a given bias field by the product of this marginal here. Okay? By the product of this marginal here. And now our term is estimate for a given observation, the beta. How do we estimate the beta? We choose the beta such that the probability for the observation is maximum. So we maximize this. And we also have to estimate the probabilities for the tissue classes, either using atlases or using just this setup with one image. And we can actually estimate these P gamma using just one observation, using the so-called expectation maximization algorithm or EM algorithm. So the P of gamma can be estimated using the expectation maximization algorithm. Maximization algorithm that is called in the literature EM algorithm. And if you want to learn how this can be done, please I refer to the lecture pattern recognition. Where we do this in detail. Here I omit this because otherwise I would have a huge overlap of the two lectures. So for us it's okay, we set up the probabilistic model. You should remember the idea of marginalization and that there are smart ways to estimate these parameters and probabilities out of a given observation. Yeah? Again, the tissue class assignment can be estimated by maximizing this prior here. P of gamma x given xy and beta y. Once again, if you want to compute P of y given x, please remember Bayes' formula. If you have P of x and y, this is P of y times p of x given y, and this is equivalent to or the same like p of x times p of y given x. And if you want to know, for instance, p of y given x, you just reformulate or reorganize this Bayesian formula and you have it. Yeah? Okay? Did I do something wrong?
Shouldn't it be divided by p?
Where? No, the base formula is correct. This is x and y,
yeah,
and
divided by the prior if you want to have the posterior
of here. Thank you. So if you want to have this, then you can write p of y times p of x given y divided by p of x. If you want to understand what I'm doing here, you have to use the prior that it cannot be difficult, what he's doing. And a ratio is far too complicated for me. So I usually prefer this type of writing, and the rest is done by massage, or by MATLAB, or Mathematica, or Maple. Okay. Maple does the job for us. If we have, this is what you should remember, and the rest is done by computer algebra systems. Use your brain for the important stuff. Good. Try to mention this in an oral exam at some colleague, you know, if he's asking some detailed question where, you know, can you tell me the five characteristic properties of blah, 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 and then you start to come up with one and two, and then you say, I'm lost, and then he says, okay, that's not good, and then you say, I use my brain for the important stuff. That's a good answer. Yes, sir. Related to my comment, the question, it's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. No, here we do not, the question was, we assume Gaussian density. Is that true that everything is Gaussian? No, it's not true. It's not true. For the tissue classes, for instance, we don't have here a Gaussian assumption. We have a finite number of classes. So this here will be a probability. So these numbers here, the sum over all p gamma, they will turn out to be 1, and we have 1/5, 1/3, 1/2 for these probabilities. So we do not do any assumption here. What we do is we assume the intensities to be normally distributed according to the mean value and the sigma of the tissue class. What is also not true? Sir? Yes. Very good idea, gentlemen. What's your name?
Max.
Max is a brilliant thinker. Can you tell me the regularizer that I should add at the end to enforce this?
The real tissue
class. Yes. How would I enforce this in the final optimization problem that P of gamma is as close as possible to the P of gamma I get out of an atlas? How would you express this? Yes, but what is the objective function? Brilliant idea. Another paper you can write. You extend just the framework here by an additional component that enforces the resulting P of gamma to be as close as possible to the P of gamma you get out of a set of atlas images. And how do you measure the similarity of probability functions? Kalbeck-Leibler, yeah? So what you do is just you incorporate into an optimization problem Kalbeck-Leibler divergence that enforces the P of gamma to be as close as possible to the P of gamma that was observed before. And if you do that, I'm sure you can get another paper. And the fuzzy Z means clustering, and this approach here was published in one of our most prestigious journals, yeah, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So I would give it a try. If it really works nicely, and I expect that it's working nicely, you can write a paper. So maybe you write the fuzzy Z means paper, and you write the probabilistic bias field correction using the prior based on Atlas images. Yeah, yeah. You can write a nice headline, bias field correction using Atlas-based priors or something like that, and the reviewers will love it. It's mainstream research. Okay. So what we sometimes do is that we do not estimate the beta ij for each pixel, but we assume that the beta ij is a parametric function over the image, and we estimate these parameters over the image. That means we transfer the problem from a pixel-wise estimate of the bias field to a parameter estimate that characterizes the overall bias. That's another trick we quite often apply, that we use parametric functions, and instead of doing it pixel-wise, we estimate a parameter. Good, and here a few examples. This is the original MRI, and here we see the bias field that was estimated out of this by using the EM algorithm. And here you see the final classification result, where you have both bias field correction and you have the class assignment. And once again, I have shown to you examples where you have seen that the intensities in MR images nowadays, they do not allow a clear assignment to a certain tissue class, like in CT. If you look at a point in the MR image and you look at the intensity value, this usually does not tell you which tissue class the point belongs to. So this step, this classification step, is one step towards the intensity-based classification of tissue classes. Yeah? So at this point, this might also have some clinical benefit. And if you look at the segmentation results and you compute the surface of the brain using the original image and the segmented image, then also the surface rendered pictures of the brain visually look way better than using the original images, which is just due to the proper classification of the intensities. And where do we also apply these techniques? They were developed for MR imaging, and we apply them also to eye images or color images where you have an inhomogeneous illumination. For instance, you see here there is a darker region and you won't correct for it by just using the bias field correction ideas. Or here you have a very dark image and you can correct for the inhomogeneous illumination. Also here, you see darker parts here, and this is the normalized image. And the other example where we applied it to, and that's also what I have mentioned in one of the previous lectures, if you use ultrasound imaging, your ultrasound waves, the deeper they go into the human body, the weaker they get, so your ultrasound signal will drop off with the distance to the surface. So your images get darker the farther you're away from the surface, and so you get also a slow change in intensities. It's getting darker and darker and darker the lower you are in the image, and this can be corrected by using the methods we have discussed in the current chapter. Very cool. Very, very nice. So what are the take-homes? Bias correction is crucial, and not only present in MRI. You can also use it for many other images and modalities. We have discussed the following classes of retrospective IIH algorithms, intensity inhomogeneity correction methods. We have talked about filtering methods, you know, the high-pass filter approach, where we eliminate the low pass or the low frequency changes in the image, or the combined high and low pass filtering, where we have used a low pass filter with a huge kernel to find the bias field, and then we subtracted this all of the original image. We have seen a histogram-based approach for bias field correction, where we have looked for a transformation or the transform of intensity such that the histogram is as peaky as possible. Yeah? So the entropy was minimized. We also have seen that we can use the KL divergence to express the histogram-based approach in terms of mathematical setup. We measure the distance to the uniform density, and the peakier one density is, the farther away it is from the uniform density that was formalized using the KL divergence. And then we have seen combined bias correction and image segmentation approaches, where we did this in this tissue class classification in parallel to the intensity inhomogeneity correction by using the fuzzy z-means algorithm or the probabilistic setup in combination with an incomplete data estimation problem. An incomplete data estimation problem was given due to the fact that we didn't know the tissue classes in advance, that we didn't know the assignment of the coins to the three students here in the first row. Yeah? That's the big picture. Okay? Now I feel way better than on Monday, so I think I fixed it now. Okay, in the upcoming 30 minutes, I have a set of slides that might be known to many of you, because we have to reconsider projection models and homogeneous coordinates. So those of you who attended DMIP or IMIP last summer semester, you all know these slides, and you can leave the lecture hall if you want. I don't care. For the others, they should stay, because I explain a few concepts that we will use from now on a lot. Because the next chapter we are considering, we are now leaving pre-processing, we are now considering the problem of generating higher dimensional information out of multiple images. So the big picture of the storyline now is, so far we have seen single images, and we thought about how can we improve these single images. Yeah? X-ray, image enhancement, undistortion, defect pixel interpolation, bias correction. And now let's think about the following problem. We have multiple images of one and the same patient, for instance, an X-ray image from this direction, an X-ray image from this direction, an X-ray image from this direction, and the question is, can I reconstruct the three-dimensional structure out of these projections? Yeah? Or like we do it with our eyes, we have two eyes, we look with two eyes, and these two pictures, which have a disparity, so they have an offset, our brain uses to generate three-dimensional information out of that. And the question is, how can we use, or how can we build algorithms that allow us to do three-dimensional reconstruction from multiple images? And to do so, it's very important to understand how the 3D world is mapped onto the flat panel detector of an X-ray screen, how the 3D world is mapped to the detector of a CT scanner, and how we can use this projection information to do a 3D reconstruction. So we have to have a good understanding of the geometry underlying the image acquisition process. And we will learn now a little bit about the math of it. And as I told you, this is a refresher course. So some of you might have seen that. So feel free to go to the cafeteria and have some coffee and enjoy life. And the others, they can enjoy research and stay here. Okay? So we will talk about projection models and homogeneous coordinates. Who in the audience has never heard about homogeneous coordinates? You all know it. Can we skip it? No. Explain it again. Yeah. Yeah. Good. So, don't read this. What we are now considering are a few core questions. How can we characterize the projection rays mathematically? So if I have an X-ray tube, I generate an X-ray beam, the X-ray beam goes or walks along a straight line through the human body. How can we characterize this? How can we characterize different projection geometries? So if you go for a X-ray tube of a vendor where you have a nice X-ray focus or a very small focus, so it's a point source, or if you go to a vendor with a very bad X-ray source where you have a smeared focus, let's say a circle of 5 millimeters or something like that, and you don't have a point source. How can we characterize the different projection geometries associated with these different setups? Yeah. How can we compute the way the X-ray particles travel through the space? Because if we know that X-ray particles are attenuated on their way to the detector, and we know which geometric track they took, yeah, or which trace they have, then we might be able to recompute what happened on the way from the source to the detector, which type of tissue classes the X-ray particles have visited. How can we estimate the camera parameters? How can we compute the path of the X-rays? And the question always is, how reliable are the estimates that I get? Yeah? How can I say it's a good mathematical characterization of the mapping, or it's not? It's a bad characterization of the mapping. Yeah. So these are the questions we have to consider. And what you should have in mind is easily explained by one image that was drawn more than 100 years ago. It shows the setup of an X-ray system. So what is this here? What? This here? You mean this here? This here is the X-ray tube, the vacuum tube. This here is the detector, and this is the hand of Bertha Röntgen, right? The hand of someone. And here, that's the generator that generates the high voltage required for generating X-ray X-rays. And the X-rays are released here, and they walk through space on straight lines and hit the detector surface. And what we want to compute is nothing else but this, the lines through the 3D space. Here is a little bit more mathematical illustration. We have our 3D world represented in terms of voxels. We have our optical center, which is the X-ray focus. We send out the X-ray particles that travel through the object and hit the detector. Okay? That means if we look at an X-ray image on our screen, we see each and every pixel. And our mental model is now doing, from now on, the following. With each pixel, we assign a needle or a ray that goes out of the image, and all these rays intersect in the X-ray focus. So if we look at an image, we don't look at the intensity or color distribution anymore, but you look, yeah, your boyfriend gives to you an image, and you look at the image, and your mental model you immediately generate is you have a two-dimensional plane. Each pixel on the image plane is associated with a projection ray. So you build up a 3D bundle of projection rays associated with the image. Yeah? But don't tell him, your friend. Okay? So that's what do you have in mind? If we see this with each pixel, we have to associate a projection ray. And this is something that Dürer did already many, many hundred years ago, of course, in the Medical Valley here in Erlangen-Nürnberg. So what did he do? He tried to understand how the color points are mapped to the image plane. How is the 3D world mapped to the image plane? And what did he do? He went to the basement, took the drill, yeah, Bohrmaschine. He drilled a hole in the kitchen wall. He put a hook in here. He had a cable here. And the hook is the the hook here is the X-ray focus. And then he took the cable and hit the surface here. And then he says, okay, this is this surface point here is silver. So he follows the cable, and the point where the cable intersects the image plane, he put in the silver intensity value or color value. And then he takes this surface point, says, okay, this one is white, white, intersection point white. And that's the way he generated this image. So what you can do is, if you say, okay, I want to generate here a discrete image, you just take the ray that intersects the focal point with the currently considered point on the image. I want to have a color point. And then you follow the line and you look which color point is hit by the cable first, or by the projection ray first. And so you can generate photorealistic images by using this simple model. And that's how X-ray images are actually generated. We do not hit surface points, but we walk along the ray and we accumulate the attenuation values. But what we need to know is, to generate this image, we need to know where is this line in 3D. So we need a mathematical characterization of this 3D line, and we will do this by homogeneous coordinates. Okay? So if we have, for instance, this situation here, perspective projection. That means we have here our focal point, here we have our plane, and here we have our 3D point X, focal point or optical center, and we want to know where this point ends up on the image plane. We get here X prime, right? And if I have another point, let's say Y, I do also the projection, and I get here Y prime. Now, and if this here has the distance F, and this here is the distance, let's say K, then I can compute here X prime and X by using just the property that similar triangles have the same ratio of parallel sides. So we have X divided by K is equal to X prime divided by F. And what we get here is X prime is F times X divided by K. That's simple geometry. But the simple geometry has one disadvantage. If we see this is the X coordinate and this is the other coordinate, this is one coordinate and this is the other coordinate, the new value here is computed out of a ratio of the original point coordinates, and that's a nonlinear mapping in terms of the components of the original point. And a nonlinear mapping is something that we don't like as engineers. Huh? Like it's written on at the entrance of MIT, I wish the world to be linear, because if things are linear, we can do math calculus, and linear algebra. And math calculus has, in our lecture, the nice side effect that we can do most of the problems by using SVD. Yeah. So the association now is, oh man, it's nonlinear, so maybe we will be lost because we cannot use SVD. So that's the bad side. Okay, it's a nonlinear mapping. It's interesting from a psychological point of view what you do with this kind of picture. Okay, good. But we are now thinking about a sidetrack to deal with this non-linear mapping in a way that we have linear mappings. And the trick that we are going to apply is we will introduce homogeneous coordinates. And let's look at two different projection models. One is the so-called orthographic projection model, where we do not assume that all the projection rays intersect at the hook in the wall, like in Dürer's example, but we assume that the projection rays are parallel rays and they intersect the plane here in an orthogonal manner. So if you have a point with coordinates x and k, you just forget about this one-dimension coordinate and you get the projection. In 3D, that means if you want to map a point x, y, z onto the x, y plane, you just cancel the z coordinate. Yeah? How can you remember this in 10 years from now? Think about the following application scenario. You send away your friend disappears, walks away, but if you use an orthogonal projection model, he will not become smaller, right? Because we just cancel the distance coordinate and map everything to the x, y axis. So if you send your friend away and he walks away, he's not getting smaller. The height of the friend is always the same because it's not scaled by the distance. That's not how our eyes work. Our eyes also have orthogonal, have perspective projection model. That means the far away things are, the smaller they get. Or our perspective model also leads to the problem that parallel lines are no longer mapped to parallel lines in our projection. So if you drive along a road and the side of the road is parallel, yeah, the left and right side are parallel, but if you look in front of you, you see that they seem to intersect somewhere. Yeah? That's why perspective projection is not maintaining parallelity of lines. Yeah? Orthogonal projections do. Parallel lines are still parallel in the orthogonal projection. So if you generate images using a parallel optics in a certain range, and you look at images of a cube, it looks very strange for us because we are not used to have, you know, these parallel lines. We always have this perspective distortion that tells us that parallel lines intersect in the projection somewhere. So it's very contraintuitive. Yeah? And now we translate this mapping in terms of a matrix vector mapping. So we want to characterize the mapping of the 3D point to the 2D point by a matrix vector multiplication. And if we map a 3D point to a 2D point, it's clear that we have to use a 2x3 matrix. And if we just cancel the third coordinate, how does the matrix look like? It's 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0. So we project the vector on the first unit vector in 3D and on the second unit vector, and we get the xy coordinate. And the third one is just disappeared. Okay? So perspective projection is a linear mapping. It's just forget about the third component and can be written in terms of a matrix vector notation. So do we like orthogonal projections from a mathematical point of view? We love it. Yeah? Unfortunately, it's not realistic, but we love it. How does it work with perspective projection? And to get closer to perspective projection, we look at weak perspective projection, where we try to model that things scale dependent on the distance. And we call this scaled orthographic projection. That's another possible name for it. So we do not map XYZ to XY, but we scale it also with a scaling factor. So we shrink it or we blow it up. It's again a linear mapping. Instead of having the ones in the projection matrix, we have the k's in the projection matrix. Just a scaling factor, okay? So if I want to have orthogonal projection plus scaling, I just can rewrite this like in the previous case, where the 1 is replaced by a scaling factor k. Do we like it? Yeah, it's linear, it's fine. Then we look at perspective projection. Perspective projection has, look at this, yeah, that's exactly the formula. We divide by the third component and we have to multiply with the focal length of our camera. So this is a mapping that takes the three components and uses a ratio of two components of the vector to compute each component of the projected value. And our reaction is, do we like it? We don't like it because it's a non-linear mapping, okay? We don't like it because it's a non-linear mapping. And if we think about this, this is exactly the scenario we have in X-ray systems. Yeah? So this is pretty much the situation we have to deal with in the following chapters. We have our X-ray focus and we have perspective projection. And we have to deal with sorry, nonlinear mappings. So let's look at the errors we get in by looking at the different projection models. This here, number one, that's perspective projection to the image plane. Yeah? Then we have scaled perspective projection where we look at x and y and then we scale it by a scaling factor up and down here. That's a two-stage process. We just look at the projected point x and y, and then we scale it by k. That's expressed here by this. And then we have the perspective projection here, where we connect just the optical center with the point. And this here I haven't explained in detail. That's the so-called paraperspective projection. That is done the following way. If you have multiple points, you compute the center of gravity of the multiple points, you project this center of gravity in a way to this auxiliary plane, and then you apply here a perspective projection or a scaling. But this one is, from a mathematical point of view, not important for us, so I skipped that. Good. So, remarks. The perspective projection is a nonlinear projection. All the others except the four, so orthogonal projection and scaled orthogonal projection can be written as linear mappings. That's what we need to keep in mind. And now we introduce homogeneous coordinates. And I'll explain this a little bit on the blackboard. The trick that we apply now is the following. We say if we look at 2D projected points, we consider them to be points in 3D. And that means we look at points in 3D and we associate with these points 2D points. And how do we do that? By a simple trick. We just say, compute the 2D point out of the 3D point by dividing the first and second component with a third component. So we transform this into the corresponding 2D point by dividing with the third, I call it W, with the third component. With the third component. That's the idea. So if I have a point in 2D, I can rewrite this, or let me write it in U and V coordinates UV. I can write this here in terms of UV and 1 and get the corresponding 3D point. And now you say, hey, come on, this is not a bijective mapping. Yeah, this is not unique. And that's right. That's right. I can also say this here is equivalent to the point k times u, k times v, k. So I can associate with one 2D point an infinite number, or infinite, an infinite number of 3D points. Are you nervous about this? I'm not nervous because if I think about the picture we have, the mental picture of images we have generated half an hour ago, as I take a picture of your friend and look at the picture, and what you grow immediately in your mind is you have this bundle of projection rays. That means with each point here, we associate a projection ray. And with this point, we associate a projection ray. And with this point, we associate a projection ray. That means with each point here in the 2D image plane, we associate an infinite number of points sitting on the projection ray. Because all these points here on this projection ray lead to the same point in terms of geometry in the image plane. Yeah? If I project this point geometrically, this point in space, to the image plane, I'll end up with the same point like with this point or that point. Okay? So what we do now is we look at the image and the 2D coordinates and we associate an infinite number of points with it. And this infinite number is characterized by a line, and a line in 3D is defined by the normal vector times the point x has to be zero, has a normal form, has a norm. Hello, come in. You have to move the camera to show these guys full screen. That would be a service. Okay, good. So that's the idea. And if we want to switch back to the 2D point, we just divide by the third component. So if you, in the future, hear something, or we use homogeneous coordinates to characterize the projections and blah, 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 you just say, okay, instead of using the two-dimensional points, we use three-dimensional points where the third component is a scaling factor. Do you feel comfortable with it? She feels comfortable with it. There's just one issue. What happens if the third component is a zero? Yeah. Then we have one point in infinity, and that's a situation we, as engineers, we try to ignore. Yeah, we try to, we just forget about it. Yeah, we add an epsilon, a very small epsilon to it. Okay, so that's what we are going to talk about. We will apply a simple trick. We extend the vectors by an additional component, and this additional component will allow us to, for instance, write affine as linear mappings. For instance, let's look at the following affine mapping. Think about the following. My new vector is a rotated vector plus a translation vector. So I rotate something and I translate it. Now, this is by definition not a linear mapping, but an affine mapping. But what I can do is, I can do now the following. I can rewrite x by x and 1. So I get a homogeneous vector. I just add the additional component. That's the last component, and I write 1. That means if I want to go back to the original vector, I just have to compute the ratio of each component by the last component. So nothing changes. But now I get x prime is r t. I just take the t vector and put it as an additional component to the rotation matrix, and I multiply this by 1, by x1. So if you do this component-wise, you will end up exactly with this. No? So I can rewrite affine mappings as linear mappings, and that's also why, as engineers, we do not distinguish between affine and linear mappings. If there is an offset, that's also for us okay. Okay? Okay? You might say this is not a convincing example. It's nice. It's nice to know and nice to remember. Okay? The more important thing is that we can rewrite the perspective projection as a linear mapping. And I'll show you how. And that this needs 45 seconds. If I have a point x, y, and z, we know that this maps by a perspective mapping to x divided by z multiplied with s f y divided by c multiplied with the focal distance. You remember that? I have had this on the previous slide. If you want to rewrite this in terms of a projection matrix, you can do the following. We compute f times the first component, we compute f times the first component, we compute f times the second component, and we compute 1 times the third component. And what do we get? We get f times x plus 0 plus 0, f times y, z. And if I want to consider this point as a 2D point with a perspective projection, I say, this is a homogeneous vector of a 2D point, and I just divide by the third component, and I get the 2D point. So in terms of homogeneous coordinates, I rewrote the perspective projection as a matrix vector of multiplication by just keeping in mind that the 2D point results out of the 3D point by just dividing by the third component. Now you think this is voodoo magic. Yeah? It's some kind of voodoo magic, but it simplifies life a lot. So what you should remember for Thursday and for the rest of your life is homogeneous coordinates means an additional component to the vector, and if I want to switch back to the lower dimensional vector, I have to divide by the last component. And then the question is, what happens if this is 0? Then you can say, as an engineer, I just add an epsilon and then everything is fine. Okay? Can we live with that? Can we survive until Thursday with this kind of information? So we should quit and see you on Monday. See you on Monday. Can you survive the weekend? Yes, you can. Thank you.